This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
In China, two Canadian men have been imprisoned for 2 years. The latest effort to win their release? Flood their jail with Christmas cards.
We want to send a message to the Chinese government. These are innocent people being held as collateral.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, lab-cultured meat on the menu in Singapore.
It doesn't taste better than chicken, and it doesn't taste worse than it. It just tastes like what you would expect.
And in Paris, 14 people convicted today in connection with the Charlie Hebdo attacks. Also from France, we have the story of the immigrant praised for his bravery during that violence.
He took all his courage to do this, to save people, so he's a hero to me.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us. We start the show today with the story of Ella Kissy Deborah, a girl whose smile could melt the coldest heart. Severe bouts of coughing sent Ella to the hospital several years ago.
I promised her that I would do everything to find out why she had suddenly become ill. I promised her that.
That's Ella's mom, Rosamond Kissy Deborah. The family lived alongside one of London's busiest, most toxic roadways. After dozens of trips to the emergency room, Ella died in 2013 when she was just 9 years old. Her mother encouraged experts to plot on a graph the link between Ella's hospital visits and the air pollution levels outside their home.
And what you can see is every time there was a spike, Ella was in hospital. And this happened 27 out of the 28 times.
Today, in a landmark case, a court in the UK ruled that air pollution was one of the causes of the girl's death. Stephen Holgate, a professor of immunopharmacology at the University of Southampton, studied Ella Kissy Deborah's case and offered testimony to the court.
She was a very healthy girl until she was 5 years old, and then asthma developed suddenly. And over 2.5 years, she had 27 admissions to hospital, which included intensive care and cardiac arrests. And when I went into the case notes and looked at the various pathological details, it was very clear that her airways were being stripped of their protective lining and that her lung was extremely sensitive to chemical pollution. She was, in fact, living on a knife edge, this girl, balancing on one side of a line which just a small trigger would be sufficient to turn her asthma into a catastrophic event.
So I asked you about the environment that led to her death. What did the court exactly rule today in her case?
It ruled that air pollution generally, created by traffic most likely, was the cause not only of the poor health she had for 2.5 years, but also the initiation of asthma. And we were able to be, the coroner was able to be quite confident about this, mainly because Ella was living in illegal levels of air pollution for all the time of her life. And this, of course, linked to the pathological changes I've just described, was why air pollution was so strongly associated with her death and her illness.
Why do you think this ruling is so important?
I think it's the first time air pollution directly has been attributed to a death of a child. And I think as a consequence of this, it's put a spotlight on air pollution, which is not just a statistic in relation to human health, where we all know air pollution is damaging. These are real people at the end of these statistics, and she was one that paid the cost.
If this 9-year-old girl's family had the means to move to a less polluted area, would she have likely lived? What's your opinion?
There are clinical trials that have demonstrated just what you've said, that a child with asthma who has just regular asthma, not severe asthma like she has, and moves from a polluted to a non-polluted area, do benefit enormously. And controlled trials have been published in this area. So I'm quite certain that if she did move to a less polluted area, she would have actually done probably quite well and certainly wouldn't have died.
I mean, Ella's tragic story has a dramatic final ending here, but this is a huge problem in the U.S. where sources of air pollution, things like coal-fired power plants, they've historically been built near lower-income neighborhoods, often neighborhoods with people of color. Is that a problem in the U.K. as well?
Oh, it certainly is. And the inequalities which you just referred to, of course, which is reflected in COVID as well as we're currently all experiencing, is very much linked to those most vulnerable. And often it's the poorer who get exposed to the worst pollution.
Do you think today's ruling opens the door to the possibility that environmental policy will increasingly be legislated through the courts, at least in the UK?
I'm hoping the United Kingdom government will respond to this in a very positive way. We need the government, as well as the medical and health authorities, to recognise that air pollution is an urgent and serious problem that really does need attending to.
Stephen Holgate is a professor of immunopharmacology at the University of Southampton. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Mexico continues to grapple with an intense coronavirus outbreak and an economic downturn. Mexico actually reopened in June, and they're welcoming tourists, including Americans. No prior COVID testing required. That has people who work in tourism in Mexico trying hard to strike a balance between economic survival and their health. Shannon Young reports from the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca.
Tourism is the number one industry here in Oaxaca. Visitors from Mexico and worldwide flock to the Pacific Coast beaches and the state's colonial capital and archaeological zones. Normally, Oaxaca City's Central Plaza would be full of tourists, but not today. Street vendors trying to eke out a living outnumber potential customers. COVID is killing the economy.
Nosotros como en el área de turismo fuimos como los primeros afectados.
Emmanuel Castellanos is a travel agent here. He says many small businesses like his have had to shut down while bigger franchise operations survive. He says he's been able to keep his office open thanks to loyal local clients and a sympathetic landlord.
Nosotros tenemos muchos clientes que quieren viajar de placer actualmente.
Castellanos says many of his clients who live in Oaxaca are also increasingly restless and anxious to travel. He says he feels like he needs to warn them of the risks and urge them to act accordingly. Navigating economic survival while trying to minimize harm to public health is a fine line many in the battered tourism sector are having to walk. In Mexico, international tourism usually brings in upwards of $20 billion a year. But 2020 might deliver less than half that amount. And this is despite Mexico keeping international air travel open, including to U.S. tourists, who other countries are blocking because of soaring COVID cases. People flying into Mexico do not have to prove they are virus-free. Tech consultant Keith White, who flew into Mexico City from Europe recently, describes the process.
So there's an electronic form that one is required to fill out, which I did, and then you bring a QR code with you to the airport, which I had on my phone.
White says he breezed through customs without even having to present his personal declaration of health. He says he's careful to travel responsibly, minimizing contacts beforehand, not moving around from place to place, and wearing a mask. But that's not always the case with other tourists from abroad, notably among the younger crowd. This can put hospitality workers at risk of infection, or at least in an awkward position.
Gran parte de ellos sí tienen esa educación de traer las medidas de seguridad.
Giovanni Aragon Sosa is a receptionist at a youth hostel. He says many visitors do respect health protocols, but others have to be nudged to use face masks. The drop in tourism has also hammered even well-established businesses.
Hemos sobrevivido, sí ha sido muy duro.
Liliana Alejandra Ortiz runs a cafe along a picturesque cobblestone street across from a centuries-old church. She says her biggest priority has been to keep her staff, but it's been hard. A recent study found that more than 1 million small businesses in Mexico have permanently closed because of the pandemic, and a whopping 94% haven't received any form of government help.
Estamos intentando como que ahora sí que hasta debajo de las piedras buscar la forma de sobrevivir.
Sandra Martinez López helps run Las Golondrinas Hotel. It's been around for 30 years, but is now on the brink of bankruptcy. Martinez says occupancy dropped to zero back in March and hasn't picked back up enough to pay the bills. Loans from friends and longtime repeat customers have helped keep the hotel alive, but it's unclear for how much longer. Government aid to hotels has generally helped larger operations, not smaller places like Las Golondrinas. A UN analysis found Mexico is the only country in Latin America and the Caribbean that hasn't set up a cash stimulus program in response to the pandemic. Mexico's president preaches austerity, but economists warn cutting corners during an emergency of this magnitude will only create deeper problems for years to come. For the world, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
A major cyber attack against the U.S. government first came to light earlier this week. Since then, we've been learning more about the scale of it. Not just Treasury and Commerce, but the Departments of State, Defense, and Justice, among others, were all breached. Now, multiple lawmakers say Russia is to blame. To break this down for us, we're joined by Lauren Zabrick. She's the executive director of the Cyber Project at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. Lauren, first of all, what is your reaction now that we have more information about the scale of this attack?
My first impressions is that this is a major, coordinated, long-term espionage campaign that will have significant impact now and down the road for sure, as far as the fallout of it and what we may do in the future.
So in our day and age, national security experts refer to hybrid warfare, which includes cyber attacks like this one. What is a proper reaction from the U.S. government if a nation state like Russia is behind this attack?
Well, we have to kind of take a step back and understand that this is not classified as an act of war. Now, when we get into this discussion, it's obviously very squishy, but we would classify it as espionage, which is, fortunately or unfortunately, a very normal and very expected thing. Now, in the cyber domain, this can be very widespread and perpetrated from afar, from over the horizon. And if it was Russia, it's all done in our networks. I think it's a hard thing for a lot of people to get their minds around because this is a very damaging operation, breaching these companies, breaching these government agencies and stealing data, but it's not an act of war. As far as what we can do about it from a government standpoint, certainly we have Cyber Command, U.S. Cyber Command with the military. Their job is to persistently engage with our, we'll say, competitors in cyberspace outside of U.S. networks.
So Senator Dick Durbin called Russia's alleged involvement in this hack, quote, virtually a declaration of war. I mean, you were very clear that this is not an act of war, but there must be a scale of seriousness here that at some point would warrant a response, regardless of who is responsible.
Yeah, and I agree with a number of people in the space who are, you know, coming out against saying something like that. I don't want to say it's hyperbole or anything like that, but we know it's not an act of war. I think we have to be very, very careful to not characterize actions in an inflammatory manner, I guess you can say.
From your vantage point, is the U.S. equipped to stave off these types of attacks in the future?
Private sector entities, state and local entities, as well as, you know, DoD networks or federal networks, everyone's sort of responsible for their own security. But we know that there is a huge gap between the number of cybersecurity jobs that are open and people that are needed and the actual number of people that we have to fill those jobs. So that itself is a huge issue. But if we're looking at this attack, we were all expecting a breach of our electoral systems, which didn't happen. And so I think we all collectively breathed a sigh of relief. But then all of a sudden we see this major, major espionage campaign happening now. And so that really indicates to me that we really need to have a much broader view of what's going on across our networks.
Lauren Zabrick, head of the Cyber Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
As the year nears its end, we've narrowed down an amazing music playlist for you from all the great global sounds released in 2020 and older stuff that helped us navigate the twists and turns of this year. You can start listening to that playlist now on Spotify. Just head to theworld.org for the link to the Tunes That Kept the World Spinning 2020 edition. And happy listening. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Nearly 6 years after the deadly attacks on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and a Jewish supermarket in Paris, justice was finally delivered today. Judges in a French court found 14 accomplices guilty. The actual Islamist militants who carried out the attacks in January of 2015 were killed by French police at the time. Joining me from Paris is Alexis Poulain. He's co-founder of Le Monde Moderne Media Group and has been following the trial and today's verdict. Alexis, a guilty verdict for all 14 accomplices. Three were tried in absentia. We'll talk about them in a moment. Explain the charges they were all found guilty of: membership in a criminal network and complicity. What does that mean?
Well, these people in trial in Paris today and for the last weeks were all involved in the attacks, and they actually managed to get weapons and get the address of Charlie Hebdo and attack these people. And that was, were charged with terror or complicity. And it was important to have this trial after all these years to make sure that these people were put to justice.
Prosecutors had been pushing for long sentences. And as we are speaking, sentences are being handed down. One of the key players in the attacks got 30 years. So three accomplices were tried in absentia and also found guilty. One of those 30-year sentences went to one of those people, Hayat Boumediene. She escaped prior to the attack but was instrumental in planning it. Explain the situation of those people who were tried in absentia.
Hayat Boumediene, for example, she fled to Syria. We lost completely track of her. And two other also were people that joined Daesh in Syria after the attacks or even before.
Daesh being the Arabic term for ISIS. So given that actual participants in these attacks were killed, how are the families of the victims seeing the verdicts today? Do they see it as justice or making the living pay for the crimes of the dead?
You know, you live all your life with the loss of a loved one, so it's not something that can bring anyone back to life. But at least it's important that we talk again about Charlie Hebdo, about these people, about what happened. And yes, to some extent, it is justice. Of course, it was expected. And it's good that in a democracy, we are actually, you know, taking the time to have a fair trial and make sure that we know exactly, precisely what was the involvement of these people.
Alexei, the bloody January 2015 attacks marked really the beginning of a wave of Islamist violence that left scores more dead in France. Similar violence just this year with the killing of a school teacher and others by militants. So big picture, how is the rest of France viewing this news? What will it do to heal things, or could it ratchet up tension?
It could, but the fact is that now we live with this terror threat on a daily basis. We had a lot of a smaller scale attack without, you know, machine guns and network of terrorists. And it's something that we don't want to get used to. There is something that the French state is fighting against here in France, and maybe also with the trial, of course, it can give more ideas or saying that France is back in the lights, on the forefront of the terror attacks. That's the way the world is going now. We have to fight against these terror groups.
Alexis Poulain is a French journalist and co-founder of Le Monde Moderne Media Group, updating us on the guilty verdicts for all defendants in the Charlie Hebdo attacks trial in France today. Alexis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today's court ruling on the Charlie Hebdo attacks is a relief to many people in France, including Lassana Batili. He's a Muslim immigrant from Mali who became a national hero for what he did back in 2015. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has that story.
30-year-old Lassana Batili has spent the last 6 years telling his story. He's traveled the world and been praised by leaders like Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu. So you can imagine the excitement here at this middle school in Plouganou, a tiny hamlet on the western coast of Brittany. Principal Hervé Simon introduces today's speaker.
Nous rappelle des groupes de personnes qui ont été visées.
Simon starts the discussion by reminding the kids that France has been the victim of more than 30 terrorist attacks in the last 8 years. One of the most recent being the beheading of a middle school teacher named Samuel Paty. He was killed in October after he showed his class satirical cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during a lesson about freedom of speech. A framed photo of Paty sits on a desk next to where Lassana Batili is standing. The next hour and a half will touch on religion, dialogue, and freedom of speech. But Batili starts by telling his personal story.
Bonjour à tous.
He came to France as an undocumented immigrant at the age of 16. It wasn't easy, he says, but in 2012, he got a break in the form of a permanent work contract at the Hypercacher supermarket in eastern Paris. He was there on January 9th, 2015. Batili was finishing up his shift in the basement inventory room when he heard gunshots upstairs.
Ça se passe porte de Vincennes dans le 20e arrondissement à Paris dans un supermarché Cacher, il y aurait des otages.
That's when Batili escorted some 15 customers into the basement and hid them in a cold storage room. They stayed there for 4 hours before escaping. Batili was quickly recognized as a national hero and given French citizenship. He finishes his story for the students and opens up the floor to questions. Do you ever have nightmares about the attack? A student asks. Batili says yes, he does. And then comes the question on many people's minds in France. How did you react to the murder of Samuel Paty? I was shocked, Batili tells the students.
Qui a juste montré caricature à ses élèves pour leur apprendre.
To be killed for showing caricatures to your students, for teaching them about laïcité and freedom of expression, it's shocking. You can be for or against either of those things, but you have to respect our culture, French culture. Teachers are putting their lives in danger by talking about French values.
Hervé Simon, the school principal, says the beheading of Samuel Paty has brought a lot of fear and tension into schools. And he says the ordeal has reinforced the importance of French values like laïcité, the country's strict form of secularism.
En fait, en France, la religion fait partie de la sphère privée.
In France, religion is part of private life, and laïcité actually helps protect religion. It tells people they have the right to believe or not believe.
Batili himself is a practicing Muslim, but sharp defender of laïcité. He agrees that religion should be kept private. That's a belief for which he has received both praise and criticism. He says the criticism usually comes from other practicing Muslims.
Mais dans leur tête, on est dans le même camp que d'autres personnes, comme vous disiez, les mécréants.
Batili tells me that some accuse him of being a non-believer. But for the kids here in Plouganou, Batili is simply a hero. Here's how a 14-year-old named Balthazar puts it.
He did something quite exceptional. He took all his courage to do this, to save people. So, yeah, I think he's a hero to me.
Batili says he struggles with that word, hero.
Moi, je suis simple citoyen qui a réfléchi un bon moment.
I prefer the term good citizen, he says. A good citizen who simply acted quickly in the moment. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Plouganou, France.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. 245 years after her birth, Jane Austen's writing still resonates with fans, maybe more than ever.
She didn't have a lot of the freedoms that we would normally take for granted about freedom of movement. So actually, I think her sense of the closed world has been very similar and very relevant to our experiences this year.
That story and more still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. If you're wearing cotton right now, there's a 1 in 5 chance it was grown in Western China. 20% of the world's cotton supply comes from the Xinjiang region. But a lot of that cotton is tainted. A new report reveals that much of it is picked by people who are forced into the fields. Adrian Zenz is a senior research fellow at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. His research has helped put a spotlight on Chinese efforts to repress predominantly Muslim minorities in Xinjiang. Adrian Zenz, thanks for being with us. You determined that more than 500,000 people have been forced into picking cotton. How did you find this out?
I have been systematically examining government documents from Xinjiang, from the prefecture government, from county governments, as well as related state and local media reports. We have extensive documentation on the region.
And the documents suggest that people are being coerced into leaving their villages and getting transported. I mean, how are they documenting what seems to amount to slavery?
They're documenting a highly coercive, top-down, state-driven poverty alleviation program that is called labor transfer, and that is turning farmers and pastoralists into factory workers with a sidekick of making a lot of minorities also pick cotton for 2 to 3 months during the cotton picking season.
So as you say, Chinese authorities call this a jobs creation program, helping poor families earn money to improve their lives. How did you determine from the data that you saw coercion and not a jobs program?
It is a job program and it does pay, but forced labor means that you are forced to do something that you don't want to do because you originally were part of a community and family structures and you wanted to remain where you were. Plus, you may not be happy with the pay you get, even though there is pay involved, because it's very gruesome work, very hard work, backbreaking, and you are paid per kilo or per pound of cotton that you pick. This is part of the so-called labor transfer of rural surplus laborers, and we know exactly what that means because this program is highly coercive from recruitment to transfer to supervision on-site, and we have a lot of evidence on that. Secondly, we have a lot of specific evidence of coercion, specifically for how the state makes the minorities pick cotton, from officials going door-to-door to perform thought transformation, meaning changing the minds of those who are not willing to go out.
How is China getting away with this?
China is very good at propaganda, even to us. It's very good at making us think that it's doing good things, lifting millions of people out of poverty. And in many ways, it is lifting people out of poverty. But in these ethnic minority regions, including the Tibetan regions, that is a highly coercive scheme that primarily is about achieving government political goals.
Your report also says that the government's motivation in China for coercive labor is not just economic. A key goal, and I'm quoting the report here, a key goal is to keep minorities occupied and surveilled. What is your evidence for that?
The evidence for that is that a lot of the factories where the labor transfer program puts people are surrounded by high walls, barbed wire, security systems, security cameras, and a lot of people live in dormitories. With cotton picking, it's similar.
Do your research and conclusions, Adrian, put you at any risk? I mean, I know you're currently in the U.S., but can you visit China?
No, that would not be safe for me. You see what China's doing in Hong Kong right now, arresting people right, left, and center. It's not safe to be in the hands of this dictatorship.
In recent months, the Trump administration has been looking at Xinjiang and forced labor programs there, and it has prevented some goods from entering the U.S. What else can the U.S. or any country do to discourage Chinese forced labor?
The Trump administration took an important first step by banning cotton and cotton-related products from a particular paramilitary government entity in Xinjiang that produces about 1/3 of Xinjiang's cotton. But now we're talking about the other 2/3, and anything that's connected to that, made with that, made from that in whole or in part, we are talking a much, much wider implication here. And it's time for governments around the world, not just the U.S. government, to act on the evidence.
What about individual actions? I mean, if there's a 1 in 5 chance that we're wearing Xinjiang cotton, is a single person not buying anything made of cotton going to do anything?
The chance that you or I are wearing Xinjiang cotton is actually higher than 1 to 5 because China produces a large amount of cotton yarn and cloth that's made with mixed fiber, partially Xinjiang cotton, partially other material from other places. So we're likely talking more than 20%, which makes it very challenging. But it's up to us as consumers to now ask hard questions. We should write letters to some of these fashion brands, raise awareness, talk about in shops. If you go Christmas shopping, tell them about this new finding, see if they've heard about it. And together, I think, we can make a difference that even now this Christmas, something about this business of oppression is going to be confronted.
The report is titled Coercive Labor in Xinjiang, Labor Transfer and the Mobilization of Ethnic Minorities to Pick Cotton. Author Adrian Zenz, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you indeed.
Two Canadians have now been in prison in China for 2 years. Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig are being held on national security charges, but are widely seen as political bargaining chips. Now there's a Christmas card campaign to pressure China to release the men. The World's Shanghai correspondent Rebecca Canther spoke with organizers of the campaign and joins me. Rebecca, remind us why these men are being held.
Okay, so to understand this, you really have to look at a much bigger context. It really has to do with relations between China, the U.S., and Canada. So just days before the two gentlemen were detained, Canadian officials detained Meng Wanzhou. She's the Huawei executive who is being accused of bank fraud and wire fraud. And she was detained in Vancouver and now is on house arrest in Vancouver. So it's largely seen that they're detainment is sort of a way to pressure Canada and the U.S. to release Meng Wanzhou.
So there's this Christmas card campaign to pressure China to release these two Michaels, as they're known. Why Christmas cards? What's the point of the campaign?
The anniversary of their detainment was just last week, and it's going to be their third Christmas in detainment. And so Charles Parton, who is a former British diplomat who knew and was friends with Michael Kovrig, says he was inspired to start the campaign when he was reading about a British journalist who had been detained in China in the 1960s. He wrote, it was comforting to find out when he was released, he found out that people around the world had sent him 3,000 Christmas cards while he was imprisoned.
Wow.
And so Charles Parton thought, well, this would be a way to show support for these two men and also maybe to put a little pressure on the government.
Do the people who are running this Christmas card campaign think or hope that Michael Kovrig and Spavor will actually receive these cards?
I spoke with Margaret McQuaig Johnson, and she's a senior fellow in the Institute for Science, Society, and Policy at the University of Ottawa. And she said, no, that's not really realistic.
We want to send a message to the Chinese government that people around the world are concerned about the detention of Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. These are innocent people being held as collateral. Likely they won't know that they're getting these cards. I hope that they'll be kept for them for their release.
But, you know, Charles Parton and Margaret McQuaig Johnson both said that they do hope that, you know, the numbers of cards will be recorded and somehow this will maybe put some pressure and maybe change the situation.
Mm. A symbolic gesture, maybe Beijing will react. What does the Chinese government say about the detention of these two Canadians?
Well, so last week at the foreign ministry daily briefing in Beijing, a journalist asked about the two men in detention. So this is what the foreign ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying said in response. So what she's saying is that the Meng Wanzhou case is purely political, and the two Canadians are in prison for charges of endangering national security. So she's again linking the two situations.
What do we know about their conditions in detention, Rebecca?
So Kovrig is in a cell that's 10 feet by 10 feet, and he's there with several other inmates. And Spavor is in another facility, and he's in a cell with about 14 people. They don't have much contact with the outside world, although they get a half an hour consular visit once a month. Actually, between January and October, they got no visits because of the pandemic. And they actually didn't even know about the pandemic until those visits started up again. So they are able to access books, but one of them, Michael Kovrig, has only had one phone call in, you know, the 2 years that he's been there. So it's not a very pleasant situation for them.
So it seems really uncertain what their future looks like. What could happen to Kovrig and Spavor?
Well, it seems clear that their fate is really tied to Meng Wanzhou's case, even though they have no connections with her. So McQuaig Johnson has been working on raising awareness about their situation, and she says she's not very optimistic about what could happen to them.
Behind the scenes, directly to government officials. They're saying, we will not give the Michaels back until you give Meng Wanzhou back. So we know that if she gets off, then she'll be sent home. And then eventually we'll probably get them back. But who knows how long that will take. If she is found guilty in the U.S. and has to go to prison, I don't know what's going to happen to them.
What McQuaid Johnson was telling me was that, you know, nothing's going to happen anytime soon.
Rebecca Canther, the world's Shanghai correspondent, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Food history will be made this weekend. Lab-grown meat will be on the menu for the first time in a restaurant in Singapore. Earlier this month, the government there became the first in the world to approve lab-grown meat for public consumption. Is this a win for the environment? We dig in today on The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Here's the world's Anna Kussmer with a report on how lab-grown meat might benefit the climate.
Hi. Hello. Welcome to 1880. How are you?
1880 is the high-end spa-slash-restaurant where lab-grown meat will debut this weekend. A virtual tour takes you past the Art Deco doors and plush couches.
So, and as you can tell by the music, it's quite a hip space. You can order a cocktail, quite social.
This is the first place where this chicken meat from not a chicken will be sold. It was invented in a lab and grown in a facility with not a beak or feather in sight. It's also known as slaughter-free or cultured meat, and it's made by taking stem cells from the muscle of a live animal and growing them in a nutrient-rich brew.
It's a combination of amino acids, vitamins, minerals, salts. That's what we call our media.
That's Joshua Tetrick. His San Francisco-based company called Eat Just made the chicken that has just been approved in Singapore. He says his meat is indistinguishable from meat grown on a real chicken.
Their response is usually, wait, it just tastes like chicken. I was expecting something else. It doesn't taste better than chicken, and it doesn't taste worse than it. It just tastes like what you would expect.
Cultured meat has been in the works for more than a decade. Now that Singapore has approved it, Tetrick hopes other countries follow.
It's no longer going to people look at this as, you know, this is a science project. Suddenly, this is a lot more than that, right? This is a large-scale commercial opportunity to reinvent how we consume meat.
Right now, around 15% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions come from raising animals. Cultured meats have been framed as a green alternative, but are they? Research from food systems expert Hannah Twomisto says for some types of animal protein, it could be. For beef, which has the highest carbon footprint, cultured meat per unit protein has the potential to lower greenhouse gas emissions by 80 to 95%. Those facilities that make cultured meat use a lot of energy, though, says Twomisto, a researcher at the University of Helsinki.
Electricity consumption required for producing cultured meat itself, the energy consumption is quite high.
Where the energy comes from makes a big difference.
So if renewable energy or low emission energy sources are used, the climate impact of cultured meat can be substantially lower compared to conventionally produced meat.
There's also the question of what cultured meat is displacing. For it to be a climate solution, people have to be eating it instead of beef, says environmental researcher Peter Alexander at the University of Edinburgh.
If people are eating this lab-based meat instead of their steak or their burger, then it could well be beneficial.
But if they're eating it instead of a cauliflower steak or a lentil burger, cultured meat is worse for the environment. For chicken, which has a lower carbon footprint, cultured meat doesn't change emissions much.
Effectively, they're a ultra-processed food. The running of those facilities, you know, requires energy as well as whatever materials that go into sort of the culture medium. And they all have emissions associated with them.
good old-fashioned plants are still a lot better for the environment. But for people who are never going to give up meat, Elaine Siu at the Good Food Institute says cultured meat is a good substitute.
You don't require the consumer to sacrifice. So they're not sacrificing on taste, they're not sacrificing on price, they're not sacrificing on convenience. You need to provide an alternative that fit all those things.
Siu's organization works to get meat alternatives regulatory approval. She says she's not surprised that Singapore was first. It's an urban country with practically no farmland.
It's a very small country. It has imminent food security issue. It imports 90% of its food.
Siu thinks Hong Kong and Japan could be next in line.
So I think we're really seeing national leaders just recognizing this is a huge opportunity.
To combat the climate crisis, says Peter Alexander at University of Edinburgh, our food systems need a lot of changes.
And lab-based meat may be one of those. Now, I don't think it's the most important one, but I haven't got a problem with it being, you know, on that menu.
If cultured meat starts appearing on a lot more menus instead of regular meat, it could help. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Tomorrow on the program, special coverage, an hour devoted to the 10-year anniversary of the start of the Arab uprisings.
An aging autocrat outorganized and outmaneuvered by kids with keyboards.
Definitely, this is the internet revolution.
10 years ago, a Tunisian street vendor lit himself on fire and an entire region exploded.
There's only so much that any citizen is going to put up with when it comes to oppression and autocracy.
A decade later, we look back on the successes.
We toppled the regime.
And the failures.
The conflicts are unfortunately ongoing.
A region torn apart by war, mass migration, and political instability. We look back and forward at Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, and many places in between. Tomorrow, here on The World. This week, LGBTQ rights in Europe saw successes and some setbacks. In Hungary, the parliament there voted to ban same-sex couples from adopting. But over in the UK, the government is making it easier for people in long-term relationships to donate blood, regardless of their partner's gender identity. One of the groups campaigning for this change was Freedom to Donate. Dan Costin is their media coordinator and joins us from London. Dan, the government is shifting away from an identity-based system to a behavior-based system. Explain what that means.
Until this change came in, it basically said that if you are a man who has sex with a man, you can only donate blood if you haven't had sex in the past 3 months. What this change does, it moves away from that very broad, very general approach, and it says, how risky is your behavior as an individual?
So walk us through, if you would, a little bit of the history of blood donation restrictions and how they've changed over the years.
For quite a period of time, as a result of the HIV/AIDS pandemic in the 80s and 90s, men who have sex with men were not able to give blood at all. A few years ago, that was reduced to you could donate blood if you had been celibate for 12 months. In 2017, Freedom to Donate, we actually secured a success from the government where we got that deferral period for several groups, not just men who have sex with men, down from 12 months to 3 months. The announcement this week is a huge step because it removes the need for any deferral periods. And it looks at, as I say, each individual's level of risk. And it says that if you have had the same sexual partner for the past 3 months, then you will be able to donate blood.
Dan, why did you want to get involved with this? And had you been advocating since 2017 or before?
The reason I got involved is because the very first time I went to donate blood as a teenager, I was turned away because I wasn't aware of the rules. Through a mixture of embarrassment and feeling it was very unfair, I became very interested in this issue. The person who actually established Freedom to Donate, Ethan, his grandfather was kept alive as a result of an 8-pint blood transfusion. And he and his family wanted to kind of pay back into the system. And they, as a group, went to donate blood. And that was when Ethan found out about this rule. So all of us who are involved have very personal connections to the issue.
Dan, how's your group, Freedom to Donate, feeling today?
Oh, we're ecstatic. To have a truly individualized risk assessment opens up blood donation to a lot more people. But it, you know, it also has the effect, most importantly, of raising standards for across all donors. And, you know, ultimately it is the recipients who need the blood who we have to keep at the forefront of all of this. And I believe that they are the ones who are going to benefit not only through more donors, a larger donor pool, but safer donations as well.
Dan Costin is the media director at Freedom to Donate. They've been campaigning for loosening restrictions on blood donation in the UK and have finally succeeded in making the change. Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Jane Austen was born 245 years ago in a rural village southwest of London. Her wit, self-awareness, and realism gave her work a place in the canon of English literature. But it's during this pandemic that she might have grown her biggest audience ever. The world's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Lizzie Dunford has been a Jane Austen devotee since she was 10 years old.
She's a legend. She's legendary.
Dunford's passion has never faded.
It's been fascinating, actually, this year, watching things pop up on Facebook, Facebook memories, and seeing how much of my life actually has been related to Jane Austen and how important she's been.
Dunford is now the director of Jane Austen's house in southern England. Today, it's a museum, but it's also the place where Austen sat down and wrote much of her fiction. During the pandemic, Dunford says she and other Janeites, as Austen fans call themselves, have returned to those books for comfort and escape. But new enthusiasts are doing so too, as parallels between Austen's 18th century life and the pandemic of 2020 have become apparent.
She didn't have a lot of the freedoms that we would normally take for granted about freedom of movement. If she wanted to go somewhere else, she had to be escorted by a brother or by other relatives and family. So actually, I think her sense of the closed world has been very similar and very relevant to our experiences this year.
Today, the Jane Austen House is mostly doing virtual tours and other online activities, including a tutorial on how to fold a letter just like Austen.
The bottom third of the letter was then folded upwards, and the top third folded down so that the edges met in the middle.
They also produce Austen Wednesdays, a weekly chat with an Austen expert.
Do you love Jane Austen? I do.
And in May, the Austen House launched hashtag #StayAtHomeAndReadJane. Admirers from across the globe have been dressing up as the late novelist and reading her letters.
And yet, we're not so very stupid as I expected, which I attribute to wearing my new bonnet and being in good looks.
Rose Servitova sent this video clip from Limerick, Ireland.
I thank you for your Sunday's letter. It is very long and very agreeable.
Servitova tells me she didn't delve into Austen's work until her 40s.
I'm totally unashamed of my passion for Jane Austen.
Servitova has written two Jane Austen fan fiction books and connected with Janeites in places like Brazil, New Zealand, and Canada. It's a warm community, she says, made possible by the Austen House's online presence during the pandemic.
It's made the world of the Jane Austen fan even more intimate.
Today, Servitova and Austen fans around the world are celebrating what would have been the novelist's 245th birthday. No big party this year, but you can pay a virtual visit to the birthday girl's abode. The Jane Austen House has published a 360-degree tour of the house. In the drawing room, visitors can listen to this German waltz, a favorite from one of Austen's handwritten music books. Wander into the kitchen, and you'll hear a poetic bread pudding recipe from Jane's mother, Cassandra.
The proportions, you'll guess, may be made more or less to the size the family chooses.
And up the stairs in Austen's very own bedroom, you'll find one of the famous letters from the author herself. It's dated December 9th, 1808.
I have so many matters to write about that my paper will hardly hold it all.
Lizzie Dunford of the Jane Austen House says the virtual tour isn't exactly the same as seeing Austen's house in person. But nonetheless, today is a joyful day.
What she achieved was absolutely extraordinary. Extraordinary.
Janeites around the world are using Austen's birthday as a moment to reflect, celebrate, and, of course, read. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online all day and all night at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.